Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show. Today's guest is Chris Michael, the interim head of technology at Open Banking. It's actually quite a lot I actually want to get through with you, because you're quite an interesting guy, interesting background, and myself have been involved in kind of the startup world, which I know you've had involvement with on kind of the investment side and the kind of mentoring side as well. So I'm curious to know what kind of ventures you've been compelled to get involved with, actually.
Sure. Shall I give you a bit of a background of my where I come from and a mini sort of run through? So yeah, I studied engineering at university. It was many years ago when everything was black and white, I say to my kids. But it was I did mechanical engineering. I wanted to be a design engineer, but what I found out in my final year was I didn't really like a lot of the topics I was studying, and I set up a business with a colleague of mine at university as our final year project, and we set up a research and publishing business, and Apple Macs had just come out, and we bought a couple of Apple Macs, and we set up effectively a syndicated research program where we ran research across students in the UK about their views on various topics relating to their potential employability and what the employers were targeting at them. So we basically created this database, and based on research that journalists would ask employers and students, and we published it and resold it. And what I did is I created a database-driven publishing system. Now, I wouldn't call myself the best coder in the world. But I realized, I kind of knew enough about coding. I ended up employing and building a technology team. We built this database publishing system. We made a bit of money. We did it as a final year project. We ran it for a few years after university as well. I then left and sold my services as a consultant in the publishing industry. So I worked for a number of the big publications as a consultant, helping them build database publishing systems. So News International, Pearson's, EMAP, those sort of guys. What happened then is the internet or the World Wide Web came along, and all of these clients that I were building database publishing systems for wanted to start doing online versions of their publication. So what was happening then, this was in the mid-90s, late-90s, is that there was a lot of digital agencies out there doing the kind of cool, sexy stuff, brochureware, animation, the sort of stuff that companies spent a lot of money on, which was quite cool. It made the internet more interesting than just hyperlinks and pictures. But I didn't get involved so much in that. I was doing more of the kind of back end stuff. Did quite a lot of stuff with video streaming, built an online subscription streaming service. I think at the time it was the largest subscription QuickTime library outside of pornography that was on the internet. Anyway, so kind of did this, and I ended up building a business around back end systems online, ended up being bought by, my business was bought by a marketing agency who was trying to become a digital agency. Went through several iterations of this, basically helping agencies grow from being a marketing or advertising agency into more of a digital agency. Ended up in 2014, I was one of the, I was effectively the CTO of Karmarama, which was an ad agency. We did lots and lots of interesting stuff. The thing that I'd kind of focused on over that time was not, like I said, not the kind of front end, cool, sexy stuff, but more the data, the back end, the database side of things and the data driven marketing. So we built platforms for big clients like BT, focusing probably on online retail more than other sectors, but across financial services, travel, telcos. And where I found a real interest was helping big brands with using data to make a better online experience. So it's kind of actually blending technology and creativity together. And the reason I like that is because what you can do is use data to prove that creative A works better than creative B. So it takes some of the subjectivity out of it. And what you can do is make a real difference by using data rather than opinion. And it's something that makes a difference to customers, but it makes a big difference to brands as well. And, you know, can potentially transform the fortunes of a big brand that's struggling by helping them understand their customers better and sell more effectively online. And that touches all sorts of different, technologies and touch points and channels from, search, display advertising, content management, general sort of digital media, but also, increasingly now mobile and mobile comms and messaging. So I kind of did that agency side. And in 2014, I decided agencies weren't really geared up to do this for clients and clients weren't really geared up to do it themselves. So I thought, well, the future is to go and do this inside a big client. And I jumped fence, I suppose, and went over client side. I spent best part of a year at the Ministry of Justice helping with some of their big digital transformations. I was then headhunted for a role at Reckitt Benckiser, leading their digital technology team. I built up a number of teams for both e-commerce, content management, and also for big data and data science. And I left RB last year, and I'm now at Open Banking, and have been for the last 9 months or so. Across all of that, what's consistent? I mentioned at the start, I wouldn't consider myself to be a good coder. I understand technology, but what's consistent across all of this is that I have built up, I think, the ability to find, build and manage teams of very high performing digital experts, not just engineering, but also user experience, product management, project management or agile management. And I think I know now how in almost any market and any organization, I'm good at solving problems that are very difficult to solve. So, and the way I do that is I try and break down the problem and understand what sort of team and structure is needed to solve that problem. But fundamentally, it's about, I've been in the game long enough to know people who really know what they're doing from people who are just okay, and going out there and finding really, really smart people. That's the start of everything. And then part of it, I say it's the third bit. It's kind of the maybe the least important part, but depending on who you talk to. But, the technology, knowing good technology from bad technology. So, I'm not a coder, as I said several times, really, and it's certainly not an anger, but I know enough about technology. I do get my hands dirty. I do dabble a little bit in terms of building apps and websites, but understanding how to make the public cloud secure, what operating systems are better, what database technologies are better for what use cases, that makes a huge difference. And it's something that I'm very passionate about keeping very close to technology and trends in technology. So, you know, those three things, knowing how to find good people, knowing what structure and processes work well, and knowing what good technology looks like, that's what I've been doing over the last few years. And, you know, it's very transferable to any sector, any type of problem that you're trying to solve. And that for me is kind of the heart of any sort of transformation. And it's not something that you just do once and then let it put it into a run state. It's a continual ongoing evolution. You have to keep your foot on the accelerator. And that's what I think differentiates a successful company from one that is going to struggle.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that there's technology is in a place now where we need people like you who are approaching things from, you know, an efficiency standpoint and obviously a way that has the business needs kind of at the forefront of everything that you do. So yeah, it's really interesting. And I would assume a compelling kind of position to be in.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. And one of the things that I've noticed as well, I mean, like I said, I always start with the people thing because, you know, I like to think I know everything about everything, but the reality is that, you know, I'm not very good on my own. I can do certain things and I've got lots of things I'm not very good at, but I kind of understand enough to know, you know, this, you need these sorts of people here, these sorts of people here. And the things that I've done that I'm most proud of in my career have been where you build a team of people with complementary skills. And that also is interesting and it's challenging as well. But, you know, finding people who have got, have you heard this sort of concept of pie-shaped people? So pie, not as in apple pie or pie chart, pie as in the Greek letter pi. So effectively you've got people who are like an I-shaped person. So they've got a very deep level of skills and experience in one thing, but they can't do anything else. So you need some people like that in any organization. You need people who are domain experts. They can do one thing really well. They know it in real depth. However, when you've got people with that skill set, they quite often really struggle to interact with other people because they don't understand the context or other people's points of view. You know, one of the most qualified people that I've ever employed had a first class degree and came software engineering from Cambridge, was an absolute technical genius, was completely useless because he, in any sort of business context, because you asked him to do anything that wasn't in that narrow field of expertise of his, and he couldn't do it and he couldn't interact. He had no social skills, couldn't interact with anyone else. And you know, that's a challenge. And then you've got T-shaped people. So they've got the same thing in terms of they're very good at one thing, but they can fit in with other people because they can understand at a narrow sort of at a thin layer, they can understand all the other skills, all the other points of view of other people with other skills, and they can work effectively in a team. But increasingly what you've got is where I think there is a need for, and where, you know, the sort of people that I try and recruit are pie-shaped people where they're good at more than one thing and they've also got that sort of bar across the top of experience or understanding of other skill sets. So an example is, you know, you're seeing quite a move now to, or I'm seeing it certainly, to full stack developers who are both really good at front end as well as back end, or they, you know, or they're really good at two or three technologies, or maybe sometimes more than two or three technologies. That, you know, they might really understand how to, you know, they might have really good sort of platform engineering skills around the Amazon stack, but they might also be a really good Java developer or .NET developer or whatever. So that, you know, they can do more than one thing with real credibility and to a real detailed level. But they also understand totally the kind of end-to-end development cycle, and they can work very effectively in a multidisciplinary team. And if you get people like that, you don't need a big team to build a big system. You just need a few very smart people who are really, really good in, you know, in their space. And you find, you know, these people are available. They do exist. You know, you need to be realistic about what your budget is if you're employing these people, which, you know, is harder to do increasingly in cities like London. But, you know, that's the key to anything, is finding, you know, identifying what the team of people that you need is and getting those people. And it's not, typically it's not like at a senior level that you look. You want people who are, you know, at the ground level, they get it, they can deliver, they can do stuff. And you need a small number of them, and they need to be really good. And then you can do really amazing things.
It's interesting that you put people first, but at the same time, I think very obvious when someone articulates the reasons why. From my perspective, the companies that tended to do well were the ones that really had the internal and the people dynamics nailed down. And that was, I suppose, something that I'd felt was massively overlooked and under talked about. And with regards to kind of any platform within business, I felt that the people aspect of things was massively overlooked. It was always kind of subject matter driven, or kind of very story driven at the same time. But I never felt that people really put enough of an emphasis on the importance of kind of the people side of things.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting when you look at that's one of the things that I know a lot of big companies are very obsessed by, is how they can be more like a startup. Because when you've got a startup, you don't go and put a big structure in place. You don't go and recruit a big team. You start with, you know, you look at, you know, what's the smallest possible thing you can do? You know, how do you minimize your cost and maximize your effectiveness? How do you do, you know, that minimum viable product as quickly as possible? It's all about, you know, speed and simplicity and solving one problem at a time and having a small team that are really good. And that's kind of the way that you do that. And that's kind of opposite to how big businesses work. And, you know, I remember many years ago, and I can't remember who it was, giving a really interesting talk about how large organizations were structured and how the, you know, and this is kind of becoming the case now. If you look at the likes of Facebook and Google, who are, you know, becoming the Amazon, who are becoming the biggest, most profitable companies on the planet, these companies didn't exist a few years ago. And so they were startups relatively recently. And what, you know, they grew from a startup in terms of the kind of culture and that ethos about going out and recruiting a small number of excellent people. And that's kind of, I think that's where they, you know, okay, fine, they had an idea or a problem they were trying to solve, but they actually started with, you know, a people first, making sure they got really good people. That's the way I always look at a problem to try and solve, because that's the way I look at how to solve any problem now. You know, first of all, have you got the right people? Because if you haven't got the right people, the problem itself might change, or the problem statement might change, that the technology might change, all of these things might change, but you always need a really, really good team of people to do anything.
I did want to ask you as well, current project that you're working on, you know, there seems to be a lot of regulation change in kind of data at the moment. You know, I actually just did a GDPR podcast with the IOC. Really interesting kind of insights onto kind of how, you know, GDPR is going to affect kind of, I suppose, all industry. But obviously the kind of the project that you're kind of working on in API standards for banking at the moment, you know, I'm not obviously not really well in tune into that space, but it seems to me like that's something similar, that's a kind of bit of regulation that's been put on there. And, you know, it seems as though it's, you know, a lot of it to do with security and data protection and things like that as well. Just wondering if you could obviously just give me a kind of bit more information on that. And
So I mean, I've come across GDPR over the last few years in a number of roles, and I think, you know, that it's really interesting when you look at, you know, what's at the heart of this is, you know, giving customers or end users access to and control of their own data, and some sort of framework in place for large organizations that they have a duty of care and responsibility to look after that data. And that's really important. And it's something that is driving an awful lot of change right now across all sorts of organizations. And I'm not going to talk too much about what I'm doing at the moment and the organizations that we're working with at the moment, but it's obviously a big issue. It's a, you know, I mean, an interesting thought though that I will say is that banks traditionally, they view data as a liability, not as a as an opportunity. So, you know, they put in place a lot of stuff which really protects customer data. So one thing I think banks are very good at is looking after customer data in a very secure way, whereas a lot of other organizations, even governments, don't have a particularly good track record, you know, around looking after data and the security around data. But the other side to it is, you know, and this is what's driving some of what we're doing in open banking, is around giving customers access to their own data. Because ultimately, you know, my bank account, my transactions, all of that, it's my data largely, so I should be able to have access to it. So there's kind of a bit of a contradiction there potentially. But I've seen, you know, a lot of, obviously I know a lot of people in technology and data across lots of different sectors. And, you know, there are a lot of very big organizations who are just going to, they are really going to come unstuck with GDPR. Not because GDPR is doing something to them, but because they are just not, they haven't for many years treated customer data with the respect that it deserves. You know, they haven't collected it in the right way. They use it to effectively spam people. They don't look after it securely. They don't store it properly. They think they can just keep on using that data for marketing purposes when they shouldn't really be doing it. So there's kind of that stuff, which I would say is bad practice, that's going on an awful lot. And I think a lot of big companies will come unstuck. There's also some interesting stuff around where I think that regulations maybe have gone too far, or companies are worried about what's happening in Europe, which potentially is a barrier to innovation. So an example of that, I think, is Google Photos. So Google Photos has got the concept in there of groups where you can tag the face of a person and give them a name, and then it will identify in your library all pictures of that person. And that's a really useful and nice thing, but it's not available outside the US, because in Europe it's you know, potentially a data privacy, data protection issue, if you can tag someone's face and then recognize them in another picture. Facebook have got the same issue with their tagging. So there's, you know, there's stuff that gets redacted because the companies are scared of things like GDPR and scared of data privacy issues. And sometimes, my point is, sometimes that creates a barrier to innovation. And sometimes I think that, you know, either the regulations go too far, or people's interpretation of it is that they're going to be in trouble, so they take a stance that's too safe. And sometimes I think that's a barrier to innovation.
Interesting. Yeah, I think so. Again, it's a difficult one, isn't it? And I think that it's again, it takes someone much higher level than I to kind of weigh that up and decide, you know, how I suppose you act according to a lot of these regulations. And I suppose it's obviously massively industry dependent as well. You know, my understanding is, I suppose the IOC and such agencies are going after a couple of specific industries. It's a difficult one, isn't it? And I think you have to really do your research. And I don't know whether there's necessarily a right and wrong answer that you can guess before the GDPR comes out in May of next year, I think. But it's kind of a guessing game at this point. It feels a little bit kind of like too dissimilar to Brexit. We're all kind of umming and ahhing and not entirely sure, you know, what's going to happen afterwards. But some people are bracing it and already acting upon it. Some people are just going to wait and see what happens. And I feel like the GDPR is, and a lot of these kind of regulations are in a very similar state. So we shall see, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting. I'm sure that it's at the end of the day, I think these things are there. The intent is right. I think these things are there to protect consumers, and they need, you need to have stuff like this to protect consumers and to protect data. I think, there is an interesting sort of thought, which is that most people really don't care about data privacy and data protection and security. They kind of, there's a small number of very vocal, active people who care, either because they're activists or it's their job to care, or, and some of those small number of people are, some but not all of them are super smart and have got it right, and some of them are just kind of create a lot of noise because it's their job to do it. But the vast majority of people are not in that space. They really don't care, and they only care about it if something goes wrong, like if someone steals their identity and nicks all their money, then they care. Of course they care. And I think people kind of think that nothing's going to go wrong, and if it does go wrong, someone else will pick up the tab. That's kind of my interpretation of general consumer behavior on this. And there is a huge lack of awareness about stuff. So there are lots of, that's why spam, email, phishing, all of these kind of scams, they work, because a lot of people are still very ignorant or gullible about stuff. And that's a real challenge for, doesn't matter what regulation you've got, that if the general public and the populace aren't educated, aren't aware of issues, then that creates a potential significant risk and problems.
I agree. Obviously someone who's, well experienced in team dynamics and such, what have you found personally has kept you kind of motivated and continuously kind of working hard, even to this kind of point in your career?
Yeah, so I think it's working with brilliant people, and I like to learn from people, and I get satisfaction out of building and leading a team that does really amazing things. And then, it's not me. I don't, it's not me doing the stuff. I just happen to be facilitating. But what I do get satisfaction out of and motivation out of is seeing how this has a positive effect on the team and the individuals within the team, and also what that means for them in terms of their career. I'm not one of these sort of managers who dictates, who bosses people around, who tries to take all the credit, who, I try and shield teams from noise, and I try and unblock things for teams, but I don't sort of micromanage. I like to trust the team. I did, for a few years, I was a rugby coach in my local rugby club, because two of my children actually were quite into playing rugby at the time. And it's a similar thing. I'm the coach, they're kids. I'm not allowed to step on the park and play the game for them or with them. It's all about how you get that dynamic working within the team. And what you find is that what I really enjoy is when you can, with a very small team, you can outperform and, beat the competition. Now that applies in a game of rugby, when you've got a bunch of kids who, they might not be the same size. They might not have, they might not have competed at the same level. And if you can get them to a situation where they can play competitively and beat a bigger team that might have more resources or whatever, that's incredibly satisfying. And I think it's good for the sport. You can apply it to any sport. And the same thing happens in business. If you can get a small team with small funding, you can build something either, you know, that, you know, it might be you win a pitch against a bigger agency or consultancy, or you make a product that a much bigger company has spent a lot more money on and your product is better than that product. That's what kind of motivates me in the one hand. And on the other hand, it's just this continual learning. I love things where you're moving into a different area, you're learning about different technologies, and you know that keeps me motivated. I read a lot of stuff, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I love learning about all sorts of different things. I suppose it's my weakness as well. I try and, you know, I spread myself too thin maybe sometimes because I'm always interested in new stuff, but that's what keeps me going.
Excellent, mate. Thank you so much for taking the time, Chris. Really enjoyed it. Yeah, great insights, mate. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.